Good news, everybody!
What? Haven't you heard by now?
The WHO is dead!
That's right. In case you haven't heard, of course we had this just a couple of months ago, United States complete WHO withdrawal, which announces that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of State today announced the United States completion of its withdrawal from the World Health Organization due to the organization's mishandling of the COVID-19 scamdemic that arose out of Wuhan, China, its failure to adopt urgently needed reforms, and its inability to demonstrate independence from the inappropriate political influence of WHO member states, like China, obviously, right? Yay, wonderful. And of course, we can follow that up with this from KFF.org, whatever that is, the U.S. government and the World Health Organization, which notes that the WHO now faces funding shortfalls and, in the absence of U.S. contributions, had to implement staffing cuts last year. Oh, almost 3,000 positions, 22% of the organization's staff, were eliminated between January and June 2025, and a number of WHO's activities were cut or curtailed. The lack of U.S. support, a shrinking institutional footprint, and other challenges raise questions about WHO's role going forward. And as if to prove the point, if all of that wasn't enough, Argentina, yes, that biosecurity powerhouse, Argentina, whither goes the world? Well, just look at Argentina. Argentina officially withdraws from World Health Organization following U.S., noting that the Argentinian president, Javier Milei, has criticized the global health body for its response to the scamdemic and has followed suit with the U.S. Department of Health and Homeland Security, Human Services, whatever they're calling it these days. Yay! Wonderful! The WHO is dead. Everybody party! Well, of course not. Of course not. And if you need indications of that, you can turn to things like this. The Governor Newsom has just met with the World Health Organization Director General and announced that California is becoming the first state to join a WHO-coordinated international network. That's right. The U.S. unsigns from the WHO, California can sign on the dotted line in some way or other. If you want more details about what that means, you can go through this propaganda article direct from Governor Newsom's website itself, or we can go to the WHO itself for this update. First ever WHO forum unites 800 plus collaborating centers for stronger scientific collaboration, noting that this WHO Collaborating Centers CC program has been exist for the past 77 years. Most people don't know about it. Why would they? They're probably not working in this space. But if you are, you probably heard about it. If not, here's a handy-dandy explainer article talking about how not only is that still in effect, but it's going stronger than ever. And collaborating centers can still be working in countries, even if they're not necessarily WHO members, right? Right? The U.S. might still be able to get in the back door that way. And anyway, everyone's going to have to pay attention to the WHO soon because of, let me put my Mad Lib words together, avian influenza, AH9N2 from, let me draw the name out of the hat, Italy. That's right. So for people who aren't keeping their eye on this, on 21st of March 2026, the National International Health Regulations, focal point for Italy, notified the World Health Organization of the identification of a human case of avian influenza in an adult male returning from Senegal. Okay, whatever. Maybe it won't be this particular case of avian influenza, but it's going to be something at some point, probably in the not too distant future. They have the scamdemic card in their back pocket. They have seen exactly how effective it can be in locking the world down at a whim. So why wouldn't they pull that out again and again? And again, as I've mentioned before, for example, CRG documenting the pandemics as a business model that was invented, concocted behind the scenes with Epstein at the core, working with Bill Gates and Bill Gates' scientific advisor. He has been doing yeoman's work documenting all of that. So I'll throw you in that direction once again if you need to get caught up on all of that. But I assume if you're a Corbett reporter, you probably know all of this, right? Well, maybe I shouldn't make an ass of you and me and assume anything. So if you have just woken up to reality in the past year or two for some reason and did kind of miss that whole scamdemic thing, or maybe you missed it because the Corbett report was taken off of YouTube for telling the truth about the scamdemic, well, now that I'm back, now you can get reacquainted with the material that you missed in my absence, including some pretty important reports that I have done on the problem of the World Health Organization, where that problem comes from, what it represents, and the danger that it represents to free humanity. So you might want to acquaint yourself, for example, with episode 445 of the Corbett Report podcast. James Corbett testifies at the National Citizens Inquiry, which I think is probably my best short form encapsulation of the history of that problem and what it represents, the threat that it represents to free humanity. But we're not here in a podcast detailing the problem. We are in Solutions Watch talking about what we can do about the problem. And the World Health Organization, I think, is still a threat. Not only the World Health Organization in particular, of course, it just represents one cornerstone of the international biosecurity agenda that is being rolled out right now, but it is an important cornerstone nonetheless. So if you want some previous work that I've done on this subject about the World Health Organization, how it can be opposed, and what we should do about it, you might want to see, for example, my previous Solutions Watch on A Better Way, talking about the Better Way conference that I ultimately ended up attending in Bath in the UK in 2023, that was put on by the World Council for Health, which is an organization that I've talked to before. So you can equate yourself with that, and you can see the presentations that I ended up delivering at that Better Way conference in the UK. And you can see, for example, my How to Stop the WHO Solutions Watch, where we were in the midst of the pandemic accord negotiations and talking about the growing international movement to derail the WHO that ultimately did result in a US withdrawal from the WHO. Well, we'll see what that ultimately ends up amounting to and whether that actually fundamentally derails the entire agenda. Color me skeptical. At any rate, I think it is important that we start to take a look at other aspects of potential solutions. And as I hope you understand by now, Solutions Watch isn't just about me and my opinions and my ideas for solutions. It's about things that maybe I don't particularly agree with, but other people in the crowd might be interested in, or at any rate, we can critically examine ideas, even if we do not necessarily subscribe to all of the parts of that idea. And today, let's look at an example along those lines. It's called the International Health Reform Project. And it caught my eye recently on brownstone.org. It's being funded by the Brownstone Institute, but as an independent body that describes itself thusly, the background of the project: the world can benefit from an international health organization that serves countries and the needs of their people, drawing on the leading scientific knowledge based on the best available evidence and acting in an ethical and transparent manner. However, the World Health Organization has demonstrated in its response to COVID-19, its current pandemic preparedness agenda, and in other areas of work, actions that are contrary to science, evidence, cultural norms, and accepted public health ethics. Over time, it has become increasingly beholden to private and partisan interests, replacing its traditional priorities of high-burden diseases with those with high potential for corporate profit. And it goes on to say that the International Health Reform Project, the IHRP, brings together a multidisciplinary and multinational panel with experience in international health, law, and the function of international organizations across several regions. The panel is examining the fundamental principles of human rights, sovereignty, and public health ethics upon which a global health organization should be run, and how the WHO currently fails to adhere to these. And it goes on to talk about the focus of the IHRP, etc. And some of the people involved in this, like, for example, Ramesh Thakur, an emeritus professor at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University, a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, and a Brownstone Institute senior scholar, and also, amongst others, Dr. David Bell, who you might remember from some of my previous conversations on CHD TV, where we're talking with Dr. David Bell about the WHO pandemic accord as it was developing. He is a clinical and public health physician with a PhD in population health and a background in internal medicine, modeling, and epidemiology of infectious disease, who's worked in global health and biotech for the past 25 years. There are other people involved in this project. I would imagine that you already suspect some of the things that I might find interesting, if not problematic, about this potential solution. At the very least, maybe I would have some differences of opinion with a former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations about the role of global governance in general, let alone the idea that we do need this international health organization really to exist in any concrete form with a bureaucracy and all of that. Well, there are things to be said about this. But then again, I'm one of those crazy anarchists who believes in human freedom and refuses to cede my individual human authority and sovereignty to any outside body, whatever hat they're wearing, whatever badge they're wearing, whatever title they're bearing. I do not recognize illegitimate political authority that I had nothing to do with and do not participate in. So, you know, I'm one of those zealots. So I, you know, maybe let's take a look for the statists in the crowd. And I know there are many statists who still believe in the statist system. Well, we have these states that are operating within this international structure. There needs to be some sort of bureaucracy. Might be an argument. So let's take a look at it. I first learned about this IHRP in this article, Crunch Time for the WHO, by Dr. David Bell and Ramesh Thacker. Which starts by noting that the polarized debate on the WHO has been based more on mudslinging and all-or-nothing dogma than scientific evidence and empirical data. However, with trust plummeting in public health and the WHO's funding rapidly falling as it scrambles for more to fund what it claims are ever-increasing threats, change is needed. The IHRP formed with the intent of returning this debate to a rational framework. It did not begin as an anti-institutional campaign, but as a professional reckoning. Its origins lie in a shared unease among physicians, public health practitioners, economists, and former senior international officials who watched the COVID-19 response unfold with growing alarm. Their concern was not with public health itself, but with the direction it appeared to be taking. Again, I have my differences of opinion about the framing of that problem and the necessity of public health as a public good that is to be administered by states, etc. But again, let's give this a fair shake and look at some of the things that I disagree with in this formulation and some of the things I agree with. For example, again, international cooperation in health is both necessary and valuable. Cross-border surveillance, data sharing, and technical assistance have contributed to dramatic gains in life expectancy, particularly in low and middle-income countries. Citation needed. Early WHO programs demonstrated what focused, technically grounded cooperation can achieve. And then we have this statement about the policy report that has been forwarded by the IHRP. It's called The Right to Health Sovereignty. The link will be in the show notes if you are interested in reading that report. And I suggest you do. Do not take my word for any of this. Do not take my opinion for at face value. You should investigate this for yourself. When you do, you'll find that the policy report advances a conception of health sovereignty that is grounded in responsibility, not isolationism. Interesting. States bear primary responsibility for protecting their population's health. Nah, I don't think so. International organizations exist to support states, not to replace or override them. International cooperation derives legitimacy from voluntary state participation. You almost had me there. When authority drifts towards centralized technocratic bodies detached from domestic accountability, legitimacy weakens. Intentions being benign or otherwise is neither here nor there. And so some of the principles upon which this report is based: individuals retain autonomy in medical decisions. Yeah, agreed. National governments lead policy. Well, that is a fact, but I'm not excited or happy about that fact. Regional bodies coordinate where necessary. Yeah, I can understand the need for international cooperation, but again, the devil is in the details. Global institutions provide normative guidance on health standards, data, for example, on disease surveillance, and technical support such as acceptable laboratory testing standards. Okay, maybe. Anyway, There's more here in this particular article, and of course, much more detail to be found in the report itself. But as I say, do not take this from me. Go and read the report for yourself. When and if you do, you will come to your own conclusions about the value of replacing or reforming the World Health Organization into some new type of international health organization that will be able to do what the WHO should do, which is provide technical assistance and details and surveillance data, etc., that is somehow going to protect our health sovereignty and allow states to become the primary determinants of our public health. As I say, I have my misgivings, but I am always willing to give people the fair shake and listen to their ideas in the quest, because I know, hey, I'm wrong about some things. I will miss certain pieces of the puzzle. Other people will see those pieces of the puzzle. So I am presenting to you a conversation that I recently recorded with Dr. David Bell and Ramesh Thacker on this very subject of this policy report, that they were the co-chairs of the panel that wrote this report. And so I had the chance to talk to them about the report, what it finds, what it is proposing in the place of the World Health Organization or as reform of the World Health Organization, how that might be possible or impossible, given the current funding system for the World Health Organization, etc. And I started this somewhat contentious conversation by pressing them on the point of why we need an international health organization with authority of any kind in the international health space, given that that seems to be the very thing that was the obviously one of the worst parts of the scamdemic itself.
Okay. And when we use authority, I think we're agreeing with what you just said, James. We're not suggesting there's an international health, a need for an international health organization that can tell people or exert authority to force people or states to do certain things. It's there as any public health operative should be, to advise people on health issues that they can interpret within their context and that a state at an international level can interpret within its context. So we see an advantage for multilateral cooperation, for obvious things, to standardize the way we manage tuberculosis, because it's very complicated and a lot of states which are poor, which tend to have TB, would not have the resources to do what you can do at a multilateral level. It doesn't mean that they can be told what to do, but if countries work together, they can work for a common good that states are then open to use. So that is more the sort of, it is not, you know, there is an authority in that it can give advice and that can carry some authority in that it's seen as trustworthy and having expertise, but not an authority that can force someone to do something with their own body or which is not with their voluntary informed consent. So those, you know, the first three of those are from, you know, essentially drawn from the Hippocratic Oath, which is the most accepted basis for the doctor-patient relationship. And then voluntary informed consent is in a way added to that, but derives from them and comes from very strongly from post-World War II human rights law and understandings in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, etc., where which was a reaction to what happens if you don't have that with both the excesses of European fascism and of the colonial period. So they govern the relationship between a practitioner and a patient or a person. But public health has to abide by those, but you're dealing with populations rather than individuals to a significant extent. So you've then got to, we see sovereign states as the most legitimate representation of the collective will of individuals. So you cannot control exactly how sovereign states work internally, and obviously a lot of states don't work like that, but it's the best model we have to make collective decisions on the international level, with the caveat that those decisions cannot or should not force an individual to act against their own consent.
Let me respond, compliment what David said with a response that breaks down your question, James, into some practical decisions that we have to make as individuals and as states. When I was in the UN system, I had a lot of international travel, a lot more than I wanted to, and it was really hectic. And a lot of that took me to countries where existing health standards and facilities and risks are somewhat different from what we might be used to in Australia, Canada, and Japan. And for some countries, certain vaccines were recommended within a period of time. It would be very difficult to think in practice of something other than what the WHO is as an international health organization that collects information on the existence of disease and the disease risks in different countries. and provides appropriate recommendations for which vaccines are recommended and at what frequency of intervals for some diseases. Now, that is given to me by way of recommendation. I look at that and say, I'm going to this country. It is still my choice as to whether I accept that recommendation or not. But if I don't, then countries do have the right to say, if you've been to country Y, and this is a vaccine that's recommended, you haven't taken it, then when you come back, we are going to put you into quarantine or test you before we release you into the community. That is for the state to decide. And I make the decision whether I want the vaccine, but then I accept the consequences. Now, in this case, almost always I did, because at that point I had full faith and confidence in the WHO. And then I'd come back and that'd not be a problem. Now, during one of those periods when I was still with the UN and we had whatever it was, I think it was avian flu or maybe it was SARS or whatever, and there was some problem in Ontario, I think, somewhere in Canada, where there were some outbreaks and the UN systems recommended against going to Canada when the Canadian health authorities were saying, we have it in control, that's not a problem. Now, I'm in a peculiar position where at that point I was traveling on official UN duty to Ontario, but I also happened to be a Canadian citizen. And essentially I said, and I'm not, in that case, there was no penalty as such in terms of being able to come back. It was just my risk. So I said, look, I'm sorry, but in this case, I have more faith in the Canadian federal government and Ontario health authorities than I have in the WHO in terms of their knowledge of the country. So I'll take my chances and I'll go and I'll come back. Third example, similarly, I've left the UN system and now back in Australia and I'm traveling for work to Ethiopia. And I was with the Australian National University, which is the only federally funded university in the country and the only national university. And we take advice from the foreign ministry, which says travel is not recommended to this country because of various risks of terrorism, which essentially was outside the capital, but they had it there. And because of that, my university declined my request to travel. And I said, look, I'm on the advisory board of some Nordic institution. They have resident embassies there. They are much more deeply knowledgeable about Africa than the Australian Foreign Ministry, where we don't have an embassy there. And they will look after and ensure my security. And frankly, I said, I have much greater knowledge of Africa in general and more deeper and more intimate knowledge than the ministry does, because I've been back and forth. And I also have a greater vested interest in my own security than does my ministry. So for these reasons, I said, I'd like to go, and I'm going to go. You can't stop me. And in the end, they accepted my arguments and let me go. So we take these sorts of decisions all the time, but you have involvement at the individual, national, and global level. And that, I think, is an appropriate balance. Now, go back to the principle, the final one, voluntary informed consent. It's important to recognize the three separate elements. Voluntary means free of coercion of any form. You can't tell me, yes, it's your decision, but we'll fire you from your job if you don't do it, which is what happened in COVID. And people who are fired have still not been rehired back in Australia. That is ethically and in practice in terms of consequences wrong, because it killed your trust in public health authorities from which they are yet to recover. Informed means I must be made aware of the full range of benefits and risks of different options, and then given the choice as to which one I want to go. And at that point, the physician, let alone the government, must respect my choice. That's what voluntary means. But it also means consent part, it's an active thing. I consent to it. You don't nudge me. You don't pressure me. You don't psychologically incline me towards one direction or other. And you don't punish the doctor for that. And you cannot, if it's going to be informed consent, stop the doctor from telling me there are these potential side effects of vaccines. It's slight, but it's there. And that's what government said. So you must not talk about that, but because there's a risk of increased vaccine hesitancy. So we departed from well-established conventions and traditions and norms in the way we manage public health. And we ignored, again, from a global governance point of view and a policy point and this point of view, the fundamental reality that policy is not so much about solving a particular puzzle as it is about engaging in policy trade-offs within the health sector. We converted national health services into COVID-only service. And we exaggerated the fear and threat so much that people voluntarily stopped going into the health service because they didn't want to overburden the health service. This was of greatest concern, I believe, in the UK, but it happened in other places also. And then we stopped screening. And particularly from a developing country or global south countries point of view, and I said this from the early on in my earliest articles, this is going to have a devastating impact on these, including, by the way, and I said this early on, including interrupted childhood immunization programs, which are absolutely essential for good health of these populations. And they will never recover that. And then it's even worse in the school closures. So what's going to happen in countries where you have daily wage laborers dependent on their daily earnings to support the family? You're going to see children return to the streets. You're going to see children trafficked. You're going to see increased child marriages. You're going to see increased child sexual traffic as well. And these are predictable consequences of society-wide shutdowns. So to protect one small group, and we knew early on the very steep age segregation of the COVID threat, you're going to punish an entire a community for several generations hence in terms of long-term consequences. It just didn't make sense in that. So these are the things we wanted to bring back in terms of, let's go back to because we have departed from fundamental principles, we need to go back and start from that and reconstitute the whole edifice all over again.
This risk of vaccine hesitancy, we hear a lot. And I mean, it's a phrase that you should never hear from a public health person at all. Because it's essentially saying there's a risk of voluntary informed consent. So there's a risk of ethical medicine. And what it's saying is that the authorities should make the decision on for people because they know best, and we shouldn't give people an option of deciding, making their own decisions in their own context. And this is not just on an individual level. We essentially saw the same thing on a national level where, as Ramesh was saying, we had this huge diversion of funds to, say, the COVAX program, which was, you know, $10 billion to vaccinate low-middle-income country people. In countries where the COVID mortality was very low, and it's predictably very low, because, one, half the people in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, are below 20 years of age. They don't get severe COVID almost ever. And, two, they already had COVID. That's by the time COVAX rolled out, and they were immune. This was taken as if you argued that if we put $10 billion into COVAX rather than malaria, which is getting worse, tuberculosis, which is getting worse, nutrition, where funding has decreased, and that will affect non-communicable diseases, in endemic infectious diseases, and the ability to respond to outbreaks. If you discussed that and said we should consider the costs and benefits before we spend $10 billion on this program, that was seen as promoting vaccine hesitancy and therefore somehow harm. But the only harm logically from that can be to the profit of the manufacturers of the vaccines, essentially, and the egos of people who are pushing them. Because what you're saying is we need to weigh the costs and benefits and work out the best public health outcome and go in that direction, whereas the pushback vaccine hesitancy is saying, no, we have to vaccinate, and that's essentially a sacred program and everything else doesn't matter, and we're not going to look at whether that's a greater good or a lesser good than spending the money elsewhere because that might harm the program.
Let's talk about something that you've raised, which is the institutional pressures that exist and that are exerted by various outside forces. Of course, private donors, as well as national government donors, and how they can influence this entire process. And then the sort of bureaucratic layer, which obviously always serves to protect itself in the event of reform or abolishment, of course. Based on the principle that the purpose of a system is what it does, can we imagine the creation of such an international health organization that arrives at any other spot than one that is determined by, say, the will of the donors that are creating that organization?
I think we can imagine it. There's a few ways that you can do. I mean, one way is to kill the organization after 30 or 40 years and reinvent it from scratch. Because, you know, like the UN, WHO, they're essentially 80 years old now, and you accumulate a lot of things there. The way that the biggest influence, I think, on change in the WHO has been through the budget process. And when it was formed, it had assessed funding from countries, nearly all its funding, so that a country gives money to WHO. WHO, based on the World Health Assembly, which is one country, one vote, for setting high-level policy, based on the technical expertise of the people in the organization, decide how that money is spent. Now about 80% of the money is specified funding, which means money is given to WHO to do something. So WHO is just a tool for the funder. You don't give money to WHO, you give money to a program and use WHO as a tool to implement it. The second change is, yeah, as you said, the largest funder, if you look at 24-25, the last 2 years funding cycle, the largest funder with about 13% is Gates Foundation, so it's private, with large pharma interests. The second funder is Gavi, which is the vaccine. It's a public-private partnership for vaccines, so it has strong industry driving, plus Gates again. The third largest funder is the European Commission, not a country. And then it's the United States, but the United States, that was because they gave money in 2024, not 2025. So then you have to, then you've got, I think it's the World Bank, and you have to get down to number six to find Germany, which is giving 3% of the funding. So a fraction of these big funders. And the reason Germany gives it so much, and it's the largest country, is because they have very large pharma investments. The government invested very heavily in BioNTech, which was the Pfizer vaccine. So that's a large part of it. So a lot of the German funding, most of it probably goes to the information hub in Berlin, which deals with pandemics, which is a WHO institution, but is essentially run by Germany. So the WHO has become, it has changed from an organization that is there for the states and does what the states want for their benefit to an organization that has no choice but to serve these non-state funders primarily. And so, you know, that's a choice of the WHO. So you can stop that happening by saying there can be no private funding or almost no private funding, that funding is assessed. It needs much less funding now because we're recommending a much smaller, leaner organization that is much more decentralized. But you can build in things like, you know, you have staff turnover. You can only be in the organization for, say, 7 or 10 years. So you don't get 20, 30 years staffing, where the institution becomes their home rather than a country that they're going to go back to. So the focus of the bureaucracy inevitably becomes protecting the institution rather than the institution's mission. So if you address staffing and you address funding and you have clear accountability mechanisms, then you can at least mitigate these harms. But you're not going to stop them completely. You need to build this into a constitution so that even in an emergency, you can't change this. There are other ways to deal with emergencies. If there's a real emergency in the world, countries will deal with it. They don't need the WHO to do it. So you can restrict it also to essentially core functions, normative functions, sharing of information, dealing with the very large endemic diseases on a capacity building basis, so that we're with the aim of essentially helping sustainability within countries so that you don't keep needing to give support.
I think, James, you again, as a student of global governance, there's four sets of risks that we face, and these risks accumulate and are quite substantial when the bureaucracy has been in existence for 8 decades by now. First is, four sets of capture, if you like, risks. First is by those who have the money. They can buy their way into influence, into setting the agenda, into controlling the outcomes, into limiting transparency, etc., etc., etc. And that includes non-state actors who take the route of public-private partnerships. We've seen that happen. The second is those who are the most powerful actors in the system. And that can happen because they bully their way into positions of power and influence and control. The third is capture by the personnel of the institution itself. The subversion of the institution from serving its mission into serving itself and perpetuating itself and increasing its budget and resources and authority and the power of the director general. And the fourth, and contrary to the first three, is a complete divorce between those who have the authority to make decisions and those who must pay and enforce and implement the decisions. And you see that most strikingly, of course, and most starkly in the UN system, in the difference between the General Assembly, where they can adopt any number of resolutions and countries can require payment when 90% of them will pay for 2% of the budget and the remaining 10% pay for the 90% of the budget. And you can see which countries end up doing that. And that, of course, promotes irresponsibility and a divorce from reality between mandating and implementing and enforcing. Now, the good news is that we have 80 years almost of experience of this on a range of fronts, including the WHO. Not exclusive to, but not excluding the WHO. And if you're going to look at foundational principles and rethinking it from scratch, then we have to address this and study this honestly and rigorously and see, okay, how can we build in checks and balances to avoid this in the future? How can we avoid conflict of interest and enforce that? And if you're not able to do it, then say we are not able to reform it and you're not able to replace it, we won't have it. If we are able to do it, it might mean renewing every 10 years or so. I mean, would we today give, if you're building the United Nations from scratch today, based on what we have learned over 80 years, would we really give permanent membership to a fixed number of countries? As opposed to saying, we'll give you exceptional powers, but for 10 years, then we do it again. So there are ways of learning. And I think human beings as social beings are capable of learning. The trouble is, the most common method of breaking through the impasse, the stalemate of accumulated vested interests has been a world war. Unfortunately, given today's technology and the costs, we can't afford that. So that's the challenge and difficulty we have faced. How can we reform structurally, transformationally, not incrementally, tweaks here and tweaks there? How can we reform that absent a major, costly global crisis? And that's where we are stuck.
All right. That was David Bell and Ramesh Thakur of the International Health Reform Project, the IHRP. So once again, I will exhort you to not take this conversation as the sum total of what we're talking about today. Instead, go check for yourself the actual document, the Right to Health Sovereignty, the policy report. The technical report, I believe, is coming very shortly at the time that I'm recording this. The policy report is available, and I will have the link in the show notes in case you want to dive into that. And I truly suggest that you do, because I think it is an interesting report filled with interesting ideas, some of which, again, I agree with, some of which I disagree with. But maybe that's the point. And just to give you a flavor of what is contained in this report, looking at the table of contents, after a chapter on the policy challenge. You then have an interesting chapter on sovereignty as an organizing principle of world order. And then the WHO under resurgent anti-globalism, the WHO's increasing focus on emergencies, rule by emergency, anyone? And WHO overreach, principles of public health, an international health organization, and a reformed WHO or a new IHO. And as I say, I think it would be in your interest, if you're interested in this subject, to go and read this report for yourself, as I have done. Because, as I say, I think there are some interesting discussions. Especially, I'm very interested in that chapter two, sovereignty as an organizing principle of world order. They make some interesting points. Obviously, this is coming from a statist perspective, but there are some interesting points to be made about the history of the concept of sovereignty, at least as it pertains to the nation state sovereignty, in which they're talking about it here in the terms of a global governance system. The history and origins of that term, meaning, origins, evolution, for example, or some of the other issues that they touch upon in this chapter. For example, World Court Advisory Opinion on Climate Change Liability, Relevance for Pandemics, where they note that as emergencies, as the emergency excuse continues to be used as the excuse for abrogating our fundamental rights, then of course, the climate change scare is obviously the bellwether, the canary in the coal mine on that subject. If they can convince you that the climate change scandal is a health scandal, oh my God, it's a health crisis caused by climate change, then they can use that as the thin edge of a wedge to use organizations like the WHO to come in and start regulating your life because you are contributing to the ill health of the planet, etc. I think my listeners will probably be well situated to understand how arguments like that work. Also, this chapter on the WHO under resurgent anti-globalism is, again, an interesting look at the history of the anti-globalist movement from its origins on the left side of the phony left-right aisle, political aisle, and its resurgence in modern times on the right side of the phony left-right divide, and how that works and some of the foundational documents and instruments that it's worked under in the past. There's even an interesting section that I have highlighted here on the FCTC and the moral framing of tobacco control, which is an interesting and intriguing subject for people who know what this is about. Essentially, the framework, the WHO's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which sounds very innocuous, but is actually one of the cornerstones of the type of operation that the WHO has, it is certainly in the 21st century, taken on to regulate more and more of our daily lives, and in some ways was the beginning of the WHO overreach into the IHR and into the scandemic times. A story that hopefully my listeners will know because they will have read my editorial on this very subject. It was called The Strange But True Story of How Smoking Bans Paved the Way for Global Government. And I wrote that in May of last year. So if you haven't read that yet, I suggest you check that out. It's along these lines. But as I say, there's a lot of interesting and thought-provoking material in here, some of which I agree with, some of which I disagree with. But I think some of it comes down to the fundamental, still that fundamental question I have about the relevance and the necessity of any sort of global institution for stewarding over public health. And I have fundamental misgivings about that concept and the way that it can be framed. Although some of the language that is used, for example, in this document, I am on board with. Other language I have my misgivings about. For example, when we talk about the role of an international health organization in facilitating dialogue and technical cooperation, again, devil's in the details. Normative guidance, harmonized health standards. That's where you start to lose me, because why do we need to harmonize across international boundaries? And who presumes to be able to do that based on solely on scientific data, as we saw during this pandemic, right? But it says that a real international health organization would focus on the root determinants of health, sanitation, nutrition, education, and chronic disease prevention, instead of prioritizing emergency micromanagement. Yes, I could get on board with those types of broad categories of ways to foster public health. But again, do we need an international health organization in order to focus on those issues? And in what way? Interventions against high burden disease? Well, again, I think there's a lot of room on the table in any such organization so empowered to start abusing those powers. And that's where my misgivings with this concept comes in. But let's look at, I think, what might be the foundational issue, at least for me, the foundations of health sovereignty. As noted above, modern healthcare is premised on the concept of the right of each individual to choose bodily autonomy or individual sovereignty. Yes, I agree. That is a statement I can get behind. But then that is immediately followed up with a statement that the right to health sovereignty has its foundations in the following international declarations and conventions: the United Nations Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the WHO Constitution, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. How about the Convention of Kiss My Ass, not to put too fine a point on it? I think the only, as I've said many times in the past, one of the only political documents from political history that I can even somewhat get behind was the Declaration of Independence, precisely because it was not primarily or specifically a political document that had to be authorized or stamped at some international or national level and all of that. No, it was a declaration. And by declaring my sovereignty, I am only recognizing a fact that exists in nature, that it pertains to the human species itself. I am a free, sovereign, individual human being. And you can kiss my ass on any of those details, on any of the words in any of your documents or any of the legal webs you try to spin around that individual sovereignty. That's the spirit that I'm looking for. And well, I don't think that this document and this international proposed International Health Organization quite gets there. But as I say, I'm a zealot for freedom and freedom of the human individual. So perhaps there are people out there who recognize the mundane realities of having to compromise on such ideals in order to live in a complicated 21st century world of international relations, etc. And so how do we go from the world of the UN and the WHO into something that more closely resembles a world of sanity in which individual sovereignty is at least acknowledged, if not always respected? And can we make incremental improvements? And what would such a body look like? How would it be funded, etc.? These are important questions for people who are interested in the practicalities of that. For myself, I am, as I say, more interested in the fundamental cause of human freedom and the philosophy of freedom, which I have talked about here on Solutions Watch in the recent past. So I we'll say, instead of these UN documents and charters and conventions and other such things, which supposedly ground the human sovereignty, individual sovereignty, I think, if not the Declaration of Independence, perhaps someone needs to reformulate the Declaration of Independence for the 21st century that will ground our bodily integrity and sovereignty and everything else, the integrity of our human freedom, in a new document, a redeclaration of independence. Is anyone out there going to take me up on that? And if not, maybe I will do it myself. Stay tuned for that. But I think there are at least a couple of things we can take from that conversation with David Bell and Ramesh Thacker that are interesting points to note. For example, I appreciated Ramesh's breakdown of the concept of voluntary informed consent as the basis for any sort of health body of any sort has to respect voluntary informed consent. Well, that is certainly a principle that I can get behind. And as Professor Thacker pointed out, voluntary means free of coercion of any form. Informed means I must be made aware of the full range of benefits and risks of different options, and then given the choice as to which one I want to go with. And at that point, the physician, let alone the government, must respect my choice. That's what voluntary means. But it also means consent part. Yes. I agree with those words and that concept, but I think that that is in itself self-refuting of the concept of this International Health Organization, because I must be made aware of the full range of benefits and risks of different options. Okay, great. I think everyone would at least give lip service to that. But then given the choice as to which one I want to go to, go with free of coercion of any form. And yet, he's also talking about, well, nation states get to set policies that if you travel to this country and you don't take the recommended vaccine, that when you come back, then they can decide to quarantine you or restrict your movements or force vaccinate you or whatever. It's the national policy. And the International Health Organization would have to respect the national policies. Well, that's subsidiarity of these organizations. So there is no international body that has a power over the national bodies. Okay, but how about subsidiarity down from the national level to, oh, I don't know, the state level, and the state level down to the city level, and the city level down to the community level, and the community level down to, oh yeah, that's right, me, my individual sovereignty and my freedom of movement. how does that factor into all of this? And who gets to abrogate that? And under what conditions? I think there are some very serious questions there, which I will grant is beyond the purview of this particular discussion about an international health organization. At any rate, it is the sort of the great hand wash of, well, the International Health Organization puts the national policy in the hands of the nation state, which is the steward of the individual rights of its individual citizens, because it's an elected democracy. So you are the government, guys. Remember that the next time they lock you down or prevent you from entering your own country or returning as a permanent resident of Japan and other such restrictions that were placed on basic human freedoms during the scandemic times. So, yes, voluntary informed consent, I agree, but I think that the very existence of international health organizations does abrogate that. And another point that I found particularly interesting was when David Bell was talking about the idea that any organization like this should have baked into its constitutional cake a 30 or 40 year time limit, as in after a generation, any organization should be completely reformulated from ground up, completely rethought. And that is, interestingly to me, as a student of history, well, isn't that exactly what Benjamin Franklin was proposing, that we need to have a revolution every 20 years, because he understood that an oligarchy is going to form. Every single time you put people in positions of power, there is going to be, well, as we now know, of course, psychopaths and others who are drawn to power, who will be drawn to those positions and will wield them and use them to transform the bureaucracy into a pathocracy, which I've talked about in Descent into Madness. So I agree that I think any sort of organization, to the extent that it should exist at all, probably should be completely scrapped and reformulated every 30 years, every 40 years, how about every 20 years, and completely broken up so that the bureaucracy does not become an entrenched interest in and of itself, that at the very least, regardless of any other conspiracy of big pharma and depopulation and anything else, at the very least, you will have bureaucrats who will be always fighting to maintain their position and to expand their wealth and power and influence, which is the institutional incentive that is basically a foundational part of these international organizations. All right, friends, we've looked at a very, very, very big idea today. The concept of an international health organization and what relevance that concept has or does not have after the fundamental breaking of whatever social contract we didn't sign that occurred during the COVID scandemic, lockdowns and masking and vaccinations and all of that. And as I say, Solutions Watch is not just about James Corbett and his personal ideas and opinions. It's about highlighting some of the various options and ideas on the table. So I hope people will take this idea seriously and will take a look at this policy report. And I would, of course, be interested in hearing your formulations of your own ideas on this subject. Does an international health organization of any sort need to exist at all? And if it does not, at what level should health bodies exist? And who should be in those positions, and what sorts of powers should any such body have or not have? Are you a statist who believes that nation states need to exist and need to take care of its citizens and look after the field of public health? Are you a Brit who's always, 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 always talking about the British healthcare system and the NHS and all of that? And we got to save the NHS, guys, as if it's the greatest culmination of all humanity, etc. Or are you, like me, a zealot for freedom and individual sovereignty and liberty? And what does that look like? And can there be cooperation, voluntary cooperation, with organizations that have absolutely no authority whatsoever, but make recommendations and technical guidance and things that people can choose to follow or not? What would such a world look like? Big ideas here, guys, and I hope that you will at least consider them and take them as seriously as they are being proffered to you. But that's going to do it for today's exploration. I am interested in your feedback. So if you are a Corbett Report member, please log into CorbettReport.com. Go to CorbettReport.com/SolutionsWatch-IHO for International Health Organization. And you can join in the comments there as well as the show notes, where you'll be able to get the link, for example, to this policy report on the right to health sovereignty. But let's end the investigation here for today. That's going to do it for this edition of Solutions Watch. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Looking forward to talking to you again in the very near future.